excited for this town to come in.
You're welcome.
So I'd like to introduce some dear friends of Lori and mine, Chris Callahan and his wife Pam. They're visiting from the west side of Portland. We've known each other since high school, and it's really a joy that they would come. They've come to some milestones in our family, like when Roman was baptized or when I was ordained as a deacon. So they've been here before, but it's nice to see them. Friends of Aslan.
Thank you.
Welcome. So, today we were going to talk about the silver chair, and I'd like to talk about the silver chair, but I don't think I want to talk about the silver chair all the way to the end, because at least a couple people I've talked to are reading the silver chair, but they haven't quite finished yet. Does that sound true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, we'll talk about it, but I won't totally spoil the ending or anything like that. And I know some of you started reading The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, but you've never read it before, and you've, in fact, finished it, which is awesome. Because if you've never read the books, you've got to read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe first. And I was happy to hear that you had. Does anybody want to have any questions or comments before we start rolling? Okay. Well, that is a good one. Great Divorce, right.
Are you going to mention that in any context or
not? Probably not. Just, it's a great book. It's another one of his imaginative works of fiction that he had already written before he started Narnia. So he's well known for some of his Christian books, including that. It's a great one. But I don't know if we'll be able to talk enough about Narnia, so unless it just kind of comes out naturally. So last week we talked about how Lewis was writing fairy tales. And that's what he wanted to write, and that was the form that made the best sense. And we said that he claimed they weren't allegories, you know, that he wasn't trying to just take these Christian ideas and then write a story to represent them, and so he was just going to put one idea into them. They're allegorical elements, you know, that are clearly there, but he wasn't writing them as allegories. But it's true, though, he was certainly writing for children, and he wanted adults to be able to enjoy the books too, because they were children's books. But he thought that if a book could only be enjoyed by children, it really wasn't even a good children's book. So he was writing for all of us, and he was about 50 when he started writing these, as I mentioned last week. But when he talks about putting that Christian element into it, this is how he described it. He said, you know, as an author, I needed a form, and that form was a fairy story. And we talked about Tolkien's theory of fairy stories last week a little bit. So he found the ideal form, and he said, but there wasn't just the author. He said, there was the man. And as a man, he said, I had to have my turn. He said, I saw how these stories, this is an essay saying, sometimes fairy stories may say best what's meant to be said, from 1956 in the New York Times. He said, I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion and childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told he ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings, and reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if something medical were happening. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. So he's kind of smuggling Christian feelings, you know, into these books. And that's how he described it, stealing past watchful dragon. So he was writing for children. It raises the question, and there's a couple of like possible problems with this. And the first problem is there really have been some critics and writers who have taken him to task for the violence in the books. There's a lot of death and bloodshed and so on. And some people have really criticized him. And so are they too scary? So maybe the first question to think about, and I'm going to give you a handout in a minute that talks about this, but the question about whether fairy stories should be scary or not is something that Lewis and Tolkien thought a lot about. So I want to talk about that objection first of all. So Lewis and Tolkien, his friend, especially from the 1930s in that era, they agreed that good fairy stories ought to be populated with wicked rulers, dangerous spells, hostile giants, deadly battles, things which some readers or their parents might object to. Lewis says when he was young, he did suffer from night fears and bad dreams, so he knew what it was like to be terrified as a kid. He wasn't interested in terrifying any children. He said, quote, "We're all born into a world of death, violence, wounds, adventure, heroism, and cowardice, good and evil." So an author might indeed be guilty of escapism if he ignored these things entirely. This is how Tolkien put it, quote, "It does not pay to leave a dragon out of your calculations if you live near him." So they're kind of getting real with it, like, this is the world we're born into, and so let's not pretend that there aren't these dark things. And this is really a wonderful quote from G.K. Chesterton. Remember, we talked about Chesterton, a great influence on Lewis, a wonderful Scottish pastor and imaginative writer. So Chesterton said this, quote, "Fairy tales do not give the child his first idea of bogey, of evil. What fairy tales give the child is his first clear idea of the possible defeat of bogey. The baby has known the dragon intimately ever since he had an imagination. What the fairy tale provides for him is a St. George to kill the dragon." So there can be victory over the darkness. So that's their justification for these stories that do contain these things, death included. But we talked about Tolkien's idea of eucatastrophe. Even the catastrophe, there's a good final kind of movement in which death itself is often transcendent. And so we won't give away too much of the silver chair, but we're going to be on the lookout for that eucatastrophe, the end of the silver chair, in which even death can't hold a character down forever. So that's one point I wanted to make about his idea of smuggled theology and the question of whether it's too scary. Another possible problem is raised in a letter that was written to Lewis by a mother of a 9-year-old American boy named Lawrence in 1955. So this is an interesting letter from the mother of a 9-year-old. So if you know any 9-year-olds, you think about Lawrence, who's that same age. So his mother wrote Lewis because Lawrence was becoming concerned, and he told his mom about this, that he was starting to love Aslan more than Jesus. Okay? And so the mother, you know, took that concern seriously and wrote a letter to Lewis. So they're reading through the books. And in 1955, the Last Battle hadn't even been published, so maybe the first 4 or 5 they'd read. She says, "Dear Mrs. K, tell Lawrence from me with my love the following. Number one, even if he was loving Aslan more than Jesus," and I'll explain in a moment why he can't really be doing this, "he would not be an idol worshiper. If he was an idol worshiper, he'd be doing it on purpose, whereas he's now doing it because he can't help doing it, and he's trying hard not to do it. But God knows quite well how hard we find it to love him more than anyone or anything else. And he won't be angry with us as long as we're trying. And he will help us." Number two. "But Lawrence can't really love Aslan more than Jesus, even if he feels that's what he's doing. For the thing he loves Aslan for doing, or saying, are simply the things Jesus really did and said. So that when Lawrence thinks he's loving Aslan, he's really loving Jesus. And perhaps loving him more than he ever did before. And of course, there's one thing Aslan has that Jesus has not. I mean, the body of a lion. But remember, if there are other worlds and they need to be saved, and Christ were to save them as he would, he may really have taken all sorts of bodies in them, which we don't know about. Now, if Lawrence is bothered because he finds the lion body seems nicer to him than the man body, I don't think he need be bothered by that at all. God knows all about the way a little boy's imagination works. He made it, after all. And he knows that at a certain age, the idea of talking and friendly animals is very attractive. So I don't think he minds if Lawrence likes the lion body. And anyway, Lawrence will find as he grows older that feeling will die away of itself without his taking any trouble about it. So he needn't bother. Finally, number three, if I were Lawrence, I'd just say in my prayer something like this, quote, "Dear God, if the things I've been thinking and feeling about these books are things you don't like and are bad for me, Please take away those feelings and thoughts. But if they're not bad, then please stop me from worrying about them. And help me every day to love you more in the way that really matters, far more than any feelings or imaginations, by doing what you want and growing more like you." End quote. That is the sort of thing I think Lawrence should say for himself. But it would be kind and Christian-like if he then added, quote, "And if Mr. Lewis has worried any other children by his books or done them any harm, then please forgive him and help him never to do it again." "Will this help? I'm terribly sorry to have caused such trouble and would take it as a great favor if you would write again and tell me how Lawrence goes on. I shall, of course, have him daily in my prayers. He must be a corker of a boy. I hope you are prepared for the possibility he might turn out to be a saint. I dare say the saints' mothers have, in some ways, a rough time. Yours sincerely, C.S. Lewis." What a great letter, though. So Lawrence really got it. You know, he was feeling deeply, you know. He loved Aslan, you know, and that's kind of what Lewis wants us to do. I want to give you a little passage from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And it's the end. You know, my favorite parts in all these books are probably when the characters have their encounter with Aslan, you know. Sometimes it's towards the beginning. Often there's one at the end, too. And the things that he says, you know, to the characters is just so poignant and touching. And it reveals a lot of Lewis's theology and so on. So without giving away too much about The Dawn Treader, for those of you who haven't read it, this would be number 3 in the original numbering, and they made it number 5 in the new one. But so what happens? I won't give away too much, but I want you to hear what Aslan says, because I think it totally just captures what Lewis is trying to do in these books. He really deeply cared about, you know, he loved God and he wanted others to know him too. So there's this moment where Lucy, so the youngest of the Pevensey children, who you meet in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. So, Mary, you know about Lucy, right? So you've met her this week. So she's in this book too. She says, "Please, Aslan, before we go, will you tell us when we can come back to Narnia again? Please, and oh, do make it soon." And he says, "Dearest," said Aslan very gently, "you and your brother will never come back to Narnia." "Oh, Aslan," said Edmund and Lucy both together in despairing voices. "You are too old, children," he said, "and you must begin to come close to your own world now." "It isn't Narnia, you know," said Lucy. "It's you. We won't meet you there. How can we live never meeting you?" "But you shall meet me, dear one," said Aslan. Are you there too, sir?" said Edmund. "I am," he said. "But there I have another name, and you must learn to know me by that name. That was the very reason why you were brought to Narnia, that by knowing me here for a little, you may know me better there." And that's just a beautiful moment in that book. That's the whole reason you were brought to Narnia. By knowing me in Narnia, you'll be able to know me in your own world. But I have another name there. And he would always write to the kids, and he's like, "You probably can figure out what Aslan's name is in your world." He said, "Sometimes the adults can't figure it out, but you can figure it out." But there is that beautiful thing, because it would be so terribly sad, you know, for them to not be able to go back. But they have to find Aslan in their world under his other name. So that's a really nice moment of smuggled theology. But he's kind of playing his cards there so we can see what he's up to. I thought now I'd talk about the beginning of The Silver Chair, so I won't spoil the conclusion. And so when I give you the handout in a minute, the second page has some talk about the plot structure. So if you really wanted to preserve all total surprise in The Silver Chair, you might not look at the second page yet, because that's about how the plot begins and ends. So it might give away something. So the first page I'm going to give you is going to talk about Narnia. Last week we talked about Narnia as a fairy story, but this week I want to talk about Narnia as romance. and not in the common sense of the term, but romance in the medieval sense of the term, like chivalric romance. So Lewis was intimately familiar with this kind of writing. He was a scholar of medieval and Renaissance literature. So he knew all of these works by Spenser and Dante and you name it, all the unnamed early English poets like Beowulf and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. He knew them just like so well. Not only because he studied them and he loved them, but as we said last week, he had a total recall. So anything he ever read, he remembered for the rest of his life. And so he decided not only to use the conventions of the fairy story, the four values and functions that we talked about, fantasy, escape, recovery, and consolation, but he wanted to make the conventions of the medieval romance overlay on top of that. So listen to what the characteristics of a chivalric romance are. Think about the Narnia stories that we know. Often it's a quest story. The hero in a romance takes a journey in search of a person, a place, or an object. So the Silver Chair, we have the one Narnia story where it's a quest story for a person. Often it's a quest story for a place. Like they're going to Narnia in the north, and the horse and his boy, or they're going to Aslan's town in which in the wardrobe, or they're going to the utter east in the voyage of the Dawn Treasure. So they're always questing for something, often somewhere, but in this case, in the Silver Chair, their quest is to find someone, right? They're looking for the lost prince. So it's definitely a quest story, and that's totally characteristic of the chivalric romance. Okay, it also has the elements of chivalry. Characters have inhabit a world of knights, pageants, castles, dances, contests, feasts. They like to embody ideals like courage, honesty, and mercy, right? The chivalric ideals. So in the Narnia stories, the epitome of this is the character known as Reepicheep, the chivalric mouse, who is like duty-bound and super honorable in his behavior. And we don't meet him in the Silver Chair, but you'll get to meet him in some of the other books. Another facet is monarchy. So the form of government in the Middle Ages wasn't, you know, a democracy. Obviously, it was a monarchy with kings and queens, princes and princesses, and so on. Now, Lewis himself said that as a person living in contemporary world, he actually advocated for democracy. He wasn't a big proponent of bringing back the monarchy in our era, in our time. Because he felt that people were just too prone to abuse power. He had a kind of a low enough view of human nature that he didn't think that the monarchy was probably the best idea. But he said as a writer and as a lover of the medieval imagination, he thought there was a sort of elegance and grandeur to the idea of a monarchy that he loved a lot better. And he thought that democracy was more like prosaic and commonplace. So as a writer, naturally, if you have a good king, why not? If you have all these beautiful accoutrements that were so grand. He liked that. Connected to the monarchy, which is like a social hierarchy. So we have the king, and you know, we find our place, you know, in society below him. He also believed in a cosmic hierarchy, which was a big part of the medieval worldview. So next week I want to talk about the planetary scheme and that thesis about the Narnia books being calibrated to the seven medieval planets, which sounds just totally bizarre, but it's been just an amazing earthquake in Lewis' studies that came out about 6 or 8 years ago by Michael Ward from England. He's a British writer, and he made this literary discovery, and it just shows one more way that Lewis was so enamored of the medieval worldview that he wanted to calibrate the seven books to the seven medieval planets. The first time you hear it, you just think it's the crazy idea you've ever heard. But the more you read his book, the more amazed you are at how true it seems to be. But he believed in a cosmic hierarchy, right? So even the seven planets, and the moon was the first of the seven planets, was closest to the Earth, and they would go from there. So the moon and the sun were both considered planets in the medieval worldview. But they all had their order. And the great chain of being is sometimes the description that you see that triangle. God is at the top, and the angels, and then you have humankind. Then you have the animals and the plants and the minerals or what have you. So that way of looking at the universe is hierarchically structured. For Lewis, that's the cosmic hierarchy that the social hierarchy was based upon. So his books really, they like hierarchy, right? So If a character meets someone that turns out to be a prince, all of a sudden, instead of just calling them by a friendly name, they drop down and, you know, bow down before them and get their blessing because they realize, hey, this is a prince, and so I'm below this person on the hierarchical scale. So for Lewis, hierarchy was not a bad word at all. Okay, other conventions of the medieval romance. Bearded enemies from the south. Oh, yeah. So like the invading Moors that would come into, you know, Europe, right, from Saudi Arabia, say, just for instance. So that was very typical in the conventions of romance. So often you see that, sort of the bad guys are coming from the south. Calamines or something like that in Horse and His Boy are a good example of that. Geography. Narnia is a flat world, right? So you get to end of the eastern, you know, the sea to the far east, and the world is just flat. It just stops because it's a flat world. That's medieval. Language is also formal and archaic. They speak in these and thous and that sort of thing. Lewis himself knew Old English and Middle English, as well as French and Latin and German and Greek. I mean, he knew a ton of languages. And the one time I met his stepson, Douglas Gresham, and I talked to him afterwards. I wanted to go up and say hi, and he's a very nice fellow. And one story he just happened to tell, I can't remember how he brought it up, he said, but you should have seen my father play Scrabble. He's talking about Lewis, my stepfather, because his mother was Joy Davidman, the woman that Lewis married towards the end of his life, so he was Joy's son from a previous marriage. So Lewis never had any children himself, but he got a couple of stepsons. But he said, when my mom and Jack played Scrabble, he said, your head would spin, because they would use any language that they knew, including Tolkien's like special language from Middle Earth. So he said it was the hardest Scrabble game imaginable. So we see that formal language. He liked that formal language. So even the silver chair, they talk about the ruinous tower. Instead of a ruined tower, it's the ruinous tower, or the tower of ruinous or something. In The Horse and His Boy, there's something... There's a place where the rivers converge, and they call it the river's meet. It's just kind of like his quirky, old-fashioned language. And then there's the intricacy and subtlety that he had in these stories. Now, this is a little bit what we're going to say for next week. But Lewis believed not only the conventions of medieval literature in terms of these outward things we've been talking about, the language, the chivalry, the quest story, the geography, but he also wanted to imitate the way that these medieval writers wrote. And one of the things that they did was that they liked to be secretive and embed meaning into their works that wasn't obvious at all. As a young man, Lewis was writing a romantic story. He wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves. So he was friends with Arthur from, like, his teens. And he wrote Arthur his whole life. And there's a whole book, I think, of his letters just to Arthur. And what he said when he was writing to Arthur, he said, you may not even get the meaning of my story. But then he said, but for as is proper in romance, the inner meaning is carefully hidden. And he was like young enough to maybe make the mistake of saying that, because he would never say anything like that later, right, about Narnia. He never let on to anything besides the Christian dimension. But that is kind of interesting. As is proper for romance, the inner meaning is carefully hidden. At one point he praised Spenser for disguising in The Faerie Queen, which we talked about last week. He disguised Venus. So Venus was a character, but Spenser put Venus sort of under wraps, so you weren't quite sure that she was there. And he praised Spenser for drawing on a Neoplatonic tradition in which all great truths should be veiled. So he liked this sort of subtle smokescreen almost. Lewis is also remembered for his observation that intricacy is a mark of the medieval mind. And Lewis is like, when he wrote poems, remember he only wrote two books for the first 30 years of his life when they went right out of print. The next 30 years he wrote 40 books after he became a Christian. And when he was younger, he was kind of in the anti-Christian phase, and he told his friend Arthur, he's like, oh yeah, a lot of these religious writers, you know, they find religion and they get really stale. They can't write anything worth a darn. And for him it was just the opposite. Because when he had that, healing of his intellect and his imagination, they could work together. And he wrote all these beautiful books. Intellectual scholarly works as well as imaginative works. So when he says intricacy is a mark of the medieval mind, it's hard to believe that he would write the Narnia books in a non-intricate way. It's hard to believe it would just be a slapdash or hodgepodge that Tolkien called it. And I think it's really sad, not to beat up on Tolkien, but Tolkien said that he would have never probably published The Lord of the Rings if it hasn't been for the encouragement of his friend C.S. Lewis. Lewis read them, encouraged him, and all that. Now, when Lewis showed the first book, before it was, you know, printed or anything, the language, the wardrobe, showed it to Tolkien, Tolkien couldn't stand it. He said he just could not even get through it practically, and he was so down on it that Lewis was depressed. And Lewis said he probably would have never gone on with the series if he hadn't had a former, like a pupil that he tutored named Green, I think his name was. I can't remember his name. But this guy also, this former tutor, liked that kind of fairy story, and he encouraged Lewis, and they talked about the story, and it gave Lewis the courage to go on with the project. But the thing is, so Tolkien just didn't get how Lewis was putting this all together. He thought it was kind of casual. You know, Tolkien worked super methodically for decades, right, to work his stories out. So again, he might have been a little jealous of Lewis working fairly quickly. He wrote 7 books in, what, 4 years? And but like we talked about last year, their view of what a secondary world is a little different. Remember Tolkien? You never want to step away from the secondary world at all because you'll break the spell of literary belief. So when you're in this fairy world, the last thing you want to do is call your reader's attention to something in the primary world because it might break the spell. Where Lewis felt like they interpenetrated more, right? So you could be in your secondary world like Narnia, but you could still talk about what a car does or a radio or a train. And that won't ruin the spell because there's this wonderful, marvelous interpenetration of the mystery between these worlds for Lewis. So he's a little different like that. Okay, finally, the thing about the chivalric romance that was really apt for Lewis is that it had a lot of Christian themes. What he liked about the medieval period is the writers drew on classical philosophy and myth and legend and Christian themes. And they put it all in. And they weren't mutually exclusive. He borrowed on all of those things. That's the very thing that I think Tolkien didn't kind of like as much. Tolkien didn't read as widely as Lewis either, which is another thing. So Lewis read super widely, so he had so much to draw from. So in medieval works like the Divine Comedy, for instance, we often have interpreters saying these are allegorical works where people and places and events clearly stand for something in the Bible or something in history. And remember last year we said how Lewis said, you know, I didn't exactly write allegory. I wanted to write a supposal. Suppose there was an imaginary world and God wanted to take on a body and he did it in a different way. Suppose then what would it look like? It's not the same as taking one biblical idea and writing it into a kind of a Where's Waldo thing where you're trying to find what he's saying, right? So that's what he wrote to those fifth graders in Maryland. I think I mentioned this last week. He said, you're mistaken when you think everything in the book represents something in this world. John Bunyan does that in The Pilgrim's Progress, but I'm not writing that way. So he's writing a supposal. But that being said, 3 of the books out of the 7 are more allegorical than the others because you can really see the Bible events pretty clearly. One is the first book, which is Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. So Mary, you know all about that because there's some Bible events there that seem pretty clearly copied or captured so that's the crucifixion, resurrection, all the Golgotha themes. And that's the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's 2 other books that are allegorical. One is the creation story, which is, what's it called? Magician's Nephew. He started that book second. He wrote the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, then he started to write the creation story. And he only got about partway through and he just conked out. He couldn't get it going. And one of the theories is on this, it might make sense to me, is that that book has the death of a young child's mother. And remember how he was about 9 when his own mother died? And he was kind of grappling with a way of dealing with the mother dying. And he couldn't do it until he finished. He actually finished all other 6 books, and then he finally finished The Magician's Nephew at the very end. And it ended up being published 6th, which was a really great place for him. So you have the creation story, which is the tradition is death you. And then the third allegorical book is The Last Battle, which is the end times, you know, and The Last Judgment. So those books work really nicely back to back. Of course, that all got goofed up with the reordering, but I don't want to dwell on it. I won't say anything bad.
Who did that?
HarperCollins Publishers.
Well, it was just a publisher decision.
Yeah.
In conjunction with the estate of C.S. Lewis. Another way of looking at Narnia, besides supposal, is the word myth, with a capital M. And this is a powerful and positive word for Lewis that should be said. Now, when we say myth, just on an ordinary sense, it means, oh, that's an untrue story that's trying to explain something that people didn't know better. And so we tell a myth, and then now we have science, and now we know better. For Lewis, that's not at all what that meant. It was a meaningful story that tried to capture truths that maybe couldn't be said in any other way. So Lewis says that myth communicates through story, and the experience that we have is more tasting rather than knowing. So for him, when you read a myth, and I think his Narnia books would probably qualify for myth in this sense, we taste something. We don't know something. There's that great quote from Maya Angelou that I saw recently. She says, "The bird sings not because it has information, but because it has a song." You know? And so reading a myth is to taste something, not even to know something. Lewis wrote this in a letter in 1956. He said, "My view that would be that a good myth, that is a story out of which ever varying meanings will grow for different readers and in different ages, is a higher thing than allegory, that is, into which one meaning has been put. Into an allegory, a man can only put what he already knows. In a myth, he puts what he doesn't yet know and could not know in any other way." So, there's a couple of ways of looking at the story. Supposals and myths. So, why don't I read a little bit from The Silver Chair that captures the quest story. So partly why this story is fun is that we find out characters are given a quest and they have to go out and try to fulfill the quest. So I won't give much away because you've probably read the beginning. So Jill and Eustace are at their terrible school. Lewis is always mocking these awful schools because he went to so many bad schools. And so he knows all about the bullies and all the problems. So they escape that school miraculously when the wall opens up, and instead of the rainy day, there's this beautiful, glorious sunlight, and they enter through the wall, and they're in this amazing place. And Jill's kind of scared, but she was also longing for something. Remember the word longing for Lewis? So remember, they go in there, and then there's this unfortunate event when the two of them are standing on the edge of a cliff because they're in this world. They're in this world that's super high up, and they look down off the cliff, and they see something that's tiny as clouds, and then even further below the clouds. So they've never been so high up in their life. And one of them gets a little queasy at the top of the cliff. Which one was that?
Eustace.
I think it was Eustace, yeah. So Eustace didn't like heights, and we'll find out Jill doesn't like crawling through caverns and caves, so she gets her problem later. But she felt kind of like, hey, I'm not scared, you know. She's a little show-offy at the top, you know. So she was kind of, proud about her not being scared. And because of the shenanigans, he ends up falling over the cliff, and she's left. And then amazingly, a lion runs up and starts blowing and blows Eustace off somewhere. So he looks to be safe, but now she's stuck with a lion on this cliff, right? And she's crying, and she's scared, right? And so I'll just pick up there. And Lewis writes, "Crying is all right in its way while it lasts, but you have to stop sooner or later, and then you still have to decide what to do. When Jill stopped, she found she was dreadfully thirsty. She had been lying face downward, and now she sat up. The birds had ceased singing, and there was perfect silence except for one small, persistent sound, which seemed to come from a good distance away. She listened carefully and felt almost sure that it was the sound of running water. Jill got up and looked round her very carefully. There was no sign of the lion, but there were so many trees about that it might easily be quite close without her seeing it. For all she knew, there might be several lions. But her thirst was very bad now, and she plucked up her courage to go and look for that running water. She went on tiptoes, stealing cautiously from tree to tree and stopping to peer around her at every step. The wood was so still that it was not difficult to decide where the sound was coming from. It grew clearer every moment, and sooner than she expected, she came to an open glade and saw the stream, bright as glass, running across the turf, a stone's throw away from her. But although the sight of the water made her feel 10 times thirstier than before, she didn't rush forward and drink. She stood as still as if she had been turned into stone, with her mouth wide open. And she had a very good reason. Just on this side of the stream lay the lion. It lay with its head raised and its 2 forepaws out in front of it, like the lions in Trafalgar Square. She knew at once that it had seen her, for its eyes looked straight into hers for a moment, and then turned away, as if it knew her quite well and didn't think much of her. "If I run away, it'll be after me in a moment," thought Jill. "And if I go on, I shall run straight into its mouth." Anyway, she couldn't have moved if she tried, and she couldn't take her eyes off it. How long this lasted, she could not be sure. It seemed like hours. And the thirst became so bad that she almost felt that she would not mind being eaten by the lion if only she could be sure of getting a mouthful of water first. "If you are thirsty, you may drink." They were the first words she had heard since Scrub had spoken to her on the edge of the cliff. For a second, she stared here and there, wondering who had spoken. Then the voice said again, "If you are thirsty, come and drink." And of course, she remembered what Scrub had said about animals talking in this other world and realized that it was the lion speaking. Anyway, she'd seen its lips move this time, and the voice was not like a man's. It was deeper, wilder, and stronger, a sort of heavy, golden voice. It did not make her any less frightened than she had been before, but it made her frightened in a rather different way. "Are you not thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink." Would you mind going away while I do?" said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. And as Jill gazed at its motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. Will you promise not to do anything to me if I come?" said Jill. "I make no promise," said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that without noticing, she'd come a step nearer. "Do you eat girls?" she said. "I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms," said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. "Well, then I dare not come and drink," said Jill. "Then you will die of thirst," said the lion. "Oh, dear," said Jill, coming another step nearer. "I suppose I must go and look for another stream." "There is no other stream," said the lion. It never occurred to Jill to disbelieve the lion. No one who had seen his stern face could do that, and her mind suddenly made itself up. It was the worst thing she ever had to do, but she went forward to the stream, knelt down, and began scooping up water in her hand. It was the coldest, most refreshing water she'd ever tasted. You needn't drink too much of it, for it quenched your thirst at once. Before she tasted it, she had been intending to make a dash away from the lion the moment she finished, but now she realized this would, on the whole, be the most dangerous thing of all. So she got up and stood there with her lips still wet from drinking. "Come here," said the lion, and she had to. She was almost between its front paws now, looking straight into its face. But she couldn't stand that for long, and she dropped her eyes. "Human child," said the lion, "where is the boy?" "He fell over the cliff," said Jill, and added, "Sir." She didn't know what else to call him, and it sounded cheap to call him nothing. "How did he come to do that, human child?" "He was trying to stop me from falling, sir." "Well, why were you so close to the edge, human child?" "I was showing off, sir." "That is a very good answer, human child. Do so no more." And now, here for the first time, the lion's face became a little less stern. "The boy is safe. I have blown him into Narnia. But your task will be the harder because of what you have done." "Please, what task, sir?" said Jill. "The task for which I called you and him here out of your world." This puzzled Jill very much. "It must be mistaking me for someone else," she thought. She didn't dare to tell the lion this, though she felt things would get into a dreadful muddle unless she did. "Speak your thought, human child," said the lion. Well, I was wondering, I mean, could there be some mistake because nobody called me and Scrub, you know? It was we who asked to come here. Scrub said we were to call to somebody. It was a name I wouldn't know. And perhaps the somebody would let us in, and we did, and then we found that door open. You would not have called to me unless I had been calling you, said the lion. Then you are somebody, sir? Said Jill. I am. And now hear your task. From here, in the land of Narnia, there lives, far from here, in the land of Narnia, there lives an aged king who is sad because he has no prince of his blood to be king after him. He has no heir because his only son was stolen from him many years ago, and no one in Narnia knows where that prince went or whether he is alive. But he is. I lay on you this command that you seek this lost prince until either you have found him and brought him to his father's house, or else died in the attempt, or else gone back to your own world. How, please? Said Jill. I will tell you, child, said the lion. These are the signs by which I will guide you in your quest. First, as soon as the boy Eustace sets foot in Narnia, he will meet an old and dear friend. He must greet that friend at once, and if he does, you will both have good health. Second, you must journey out of Narnia to the north, till you come to the ruined city of the giants. Third, you shall find a writing on a stone in that ruined city, and you must do what the writing tells you. Fourth, you will know the lost prince if you find him by this. He will be the first person you have met in your travels who will ask you to do something in my name, in the name of Aslan. As the lion seemed to have finished, Jill thought she should say something. So she said, thank you very much, I see. Child, said Aslan in a gentler voice, perhaps you do not see quite as well as you think. But the first step is to remember. Repeat to me in order the four signs. Excuse me. So, maybe I'll stop there. So there's the quest. Even Aslan calls it a quest. I'm sending you on a quest, but it's not just, you know, to find the lost prince who is alive. He knows this. But it's accompanied by learning the four signs. And there's so the way Lewis is wording his Bible themes in here, this is not allegorical so much as he's making allusions or brief references to biblical things. Like in the Gospel of John, you have, come to me... if you are thirsty, and I'll give you a living water, or something like that. So he's alluding to that. He's alluding to Exodus, when Moses is given the name of God in the burning bush. Who should I say sent me? You know, Moses is being sent on a quest himself. Go take the people of Israel, lead them out of Egypt. And, you know, and he has tons of objections to that, you know, but God's like, you know, you're going to do that. I'm going to send you on this. He said, well, what's your name? And he says, I am. My name is I am. So that great name, Yahweh, or I will be who I will be, that was the first time that name was ever given. It was given to Moses in the burning bush by God himself. And we understand that to be the second person of the Trinity, speaking to Moses, saying, I am. So when Jesus in the Gospels is saying, I am, before Abraham was, I am, he's also speaking the same thing he spoke to Moses in the burning bush. So when Jill says, are you somebody? I am. So that's not just like a, you know, simple sentence. That basically is a Christological statement. You know, I am. I am God. And then finally, the remembering the signs, I have to look this up, but it's in Deuteronomy. And so... So this passage that I think is referred to, the Shema. They call it the Shema. Hear, O Israel. It's a great Jewish creed, the statement of faith. Hear, O Israel. The Lord our God is one Lord. And that's Yahweh. That's the name from the bush, the Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and with all thy might. And then we know in the New Testament where Jesus says, with your mind. But this says, with all your heart, soul, and strength. And these words, which I command these days, shall be in thy heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently to thy children, Then shall talk of them when thou sit in thy house, and when thou walk by the way, and when thou lie down, and when thou raise up. And you shall bind them for a sign on thy hand, and they shall be frontlets between thy eyes. You shall write them on the post of your house. So, anyways, remember the signs. You know, that's really what the people of Israel are being told by God. I'm giving you this law, but don't forget it. Because if you forget it, your quest is going to be a lot harder. And so, remember the signs. So here's Lewis referring to Deuteronomy, the Gospel of John, the book of Exodus. I mean, there's probably more. That's all in chapter 2 there. But it's not really heavy, and it's not super obvious. So, you know, if you know your Bible well, you probably pick up on all of those things. But a lot of people wouldn't. But he's not so concerned with it being conscious. He thought the things that were subconscious went deeper than things that are conscious. So his story of intricacy and what he called atmosphere, we'll talk about this next week, working up an atmosphere is because he wanted something to penetrate really deeply into our hearts. And so that's why this story is much less allegorical and much more, there's more allusion. I better check my time. Mm.
Oh, you 22.
22, so we got a little bit more time. What time do we start?
12:45.
Oh, so we're about, yeah, we're almost done. Okay. Maybe we should see if there's any comments or questions before we wrap it up.
I think we started later than that, so you can go longer. That's
you want to go in like 5 minutes? Okay. All right. Still, do we have any comments or questions? Yeah. He's always working out these theological points about free will and God's providence.
But there's a lot there about language itself. I mean, it seems to relate quite a bit to the epistle this morning, where Paul is caught up in hearing words that are not lawful for him to speak. We're not, words that we're hearing certainly are lawful for us to speak, but the understanding of those words is falling away. And it's like our quest, part of our quest is to keep the meaning of those words alive and to further imbue them with meaning based on our experience here, you know, with the services.
About the business of him seeming like having hurt, seeing that all of them have rejected me for unlovingness. It reminded me of until that they could take that same place where all seems to God and recognizing it. It's so beautiful, but she saw this kind of look at rejection there too, because the sin that he saw. Who she really was. But she, But anyway, and so when she said that there in the book, it really struck me, and I wasn't exactly sure if it did me what to think. But I just thought, he lets us see that with him. He doesn't overwhelm us. I just found it really interesting.
Those fairy tales do have a lot of scary elements. Even in the full grown man can find some terror. And our littler ones might, not found those to be that. With the cross and death and resurrection, hopefully there's some kind of union that balances things out.
Connie says, maybe it'd be fun. fun if we all read the whole series this winter, you know, just among ourselves, you know, why not? This is sort of like priming the pump that, you know, maybe we want to do that. Because one scholar said something like this, it's like, children can read the book and it will help them, let's see, like Aslan will help prepare them to meet Christ, but he said adults can read it and they can be reintroduced to their feelings for Christ through Aslan, something of that nature. Some of you have had that experience, I know. And so it's so beautiful that these books are really faith-building sort of experiences when you read them.
I mean, this is a good one. I have CDs.
Yeah, you can get British people reading them. So, sounds more like Lewis.
So what I would like to say, I'm not a big fan of Rudolf Steiner, but the one thing that he said that just reminds me of, what you just said reminds me of, and I've said this a lot, he said, beauty and order awaken the soul to God and prepare it to receive knowledge of Him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and yeah. Later on, and perhaps it would be more explicit, but
St. Basil says something very similar to that too. You know, like make the best of like the classical legends and stories. That's St. Basil. Let me just throw in a couple of things before we wrap it up. One is the journey to the underworld. So this is a story of descent, right? So if you haven't made it that far, I'll give it away. They're going to go underground for a while, but I won't tell you a whole lot more about it. But that's a classical, like what you call an archetype. That's a thing that repeats a lot, where a hero has to go to the underworld and maybe bring something back out. So here are some examples. Hercules does this. Orpheus does this to rescue his wife, Eurydice, who was a victim of a snake bite. Very interesting parallel to Prince Rillian. Orpheus fails because he disobeys the instructions, and he looks back to see her face before they arrive at the upper world. So that kind of sounds a little bit like something in
Lot's wife.
Yeah, Lot's wife and Genesis. So this idea of descending and reascending, of course, has the idea of a myth becoming fact. You know, we talk about Lewis and the incarnation is, you know, God became man. It was still a myth, but this time it was a true myth. You know, and all these other stories like Balder the Beautiful and all that, that was just a story, but it actually happened with Jesus Christ. He was God, and He became a man, He died, and He rose. And same with the whole idea of the hero takes a journey to the underworld, so we have all these myths. But in the New Testament, we have Ephesians 4, Paul says, Christ descended to the lower parts of the earth. Or 1 Peter 3, Christ preached to the spirits in prison. That's why the fathers talk about the Lord, you know, descending into Hades and bringing up, you know, those with Him. So there's a Christian dimension to this. Let's see. Maybe real quickly, talking about Lewis's language in the books. Tolkien didn't like the language. He thought it was just kind of prosaic and ho-hum. I want to give you an example of a contemporary writer who just absolutely is in love with it. His name is Lev Grossman. And he writes novels sort of inspired by Lewis. I've never read them myself. Has anybody read these? Lev Grossman, his novel was called The Magician's Land. It's supposed to be like a more grown-up version of Narnia, but he's a book critic for Time magazine, and he writes these fantasy books. But there's a really interesting appreciation of Lewis in an interview with this guy, Lev Grossman. Maybe we should read one of his books to see if it's any good. But he says, why is Lewis so important to me? In part, he tells the story with truly exemplary economy. The point of view of his craft. He says, by the time we're only 6 or 7 pages into Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, we already know the 4 Pevensies. We know how they feel about the other 3, each one. He's got Lucy through the wardrobe. With incredible speed, he acquaints us with all the characters. But even more than that, it's the way he uses language, which is nothing like the way fantasy writers used before him. There's no sense of nostalgia. It's very straight and clean, but with very specific physical details. He's making magic, but he's making it out of very ordinary physical impressions. It's very powerful, it's very new. Kind of reminds me of the Lord's parables, and he would tell these things about, stories about the kingdom of God, but he would use the most ordinary stories, right? Somebody lost a coin, or, you know, somebody was at work, you know, whatever. So he's using ordinary language to convey something extraordinary. It works because he's writing fantasy, but working with the tools of realism. Even though he had this wonderful romantic yearning nostalgia, he writes like a modernist. He writes like Hemingway or James Joyce of Dubliners. So like early James Joyce, when he was writing these great short stories about his childhood in Dublin, I thought it was pretty neat. It was the first time I'd ever seen anybody compare Lewis to Hemingway. Wow. Love it. So he appreciates Lewis' simplicity of language. Final thing I want to talk about is names in Lewis. Lewis's names of his characters reveal his sense of good and evil. He really believed he had a child's sense of terror and joy and good and evil. And he had that his whole life. And he had what you would call old-fashioned tastes in poetry. So in old-fashioned poetics, certain consonants carried certain meanings, and certain consonants carried other meanings. Let me tell you the consonants that he liked. So his good characters are going to have L's and R's, which are called liquids. Rillian. You know Rillian's going to be a great character because he's got an R and an L. And an N and an M, because M and N's are called nasals. He loved M's and N's. Moleldil, Aslan. Okay? So he loved liquids and nasals. Those consonants are associated with good things in Lewis's works. And if you look through all of his characters, you'll see that the liquids and nasals are usually the good characters. Aslan, Moleldu, Ramandu, Rillian. By contrast, the other consonants in this traditional poetic, remember he was like a super English guy, so he was way in tune with the minute aspects of language. The so-called fricatives and plosives, which are the F, V, and Z, and the plosives are the PBJs, like peanut butter and jelly. PBJ, C's and K's, T's and D's. They sound a little harsher and more prosaic. So Lewis's characters with fricatives and plosives are not good characters. You've got Miraz, the usurping politician king. You've got Jadis, right, with a J. So those are the J's in our name. That doesn't bode so well for us. Or C's or K's, like the hard C. So I wouldn't be personally a good character in his books, but Toadpipe, Slubgob, Gumpus, Nicabrick. These are all fricative and plosive names. And remember the bullies? The one that really struck me was Edith Jackal. She was a bad character. Edith Jackal. So we got to be on the lookout. So what's interesting about Caspian, he's a good Narnian king. His C at the beginning of his name, that hard K sound, that's a bad start, but it ends with an N. And it was observed by David Downing, this great Lewis scholar. He says, Caspian is a good Narnian king with a bad lineage because he came from Telmarine Pilate. So he started bad with a K, but he ended well with an N. And he ended up being, poetically speaking, he started badly, but he ended well. So Lewis loved the sounds of words. He said his favorite sound was that short U sound, like nut, like peanut, N-U-T. And he thought the greatest name for a dog would be K-N-U-T-T, nut. He thought that would be a great name for a dog because it was very homely sounding. He thought it was a very humble sound, like nut. So think of his characters that have this sound. Trumpkin the Dwarf, Tumnus the Fawn, Truffle Hunter the Badger, Duffel Pods, Mola Guthrum in the Silver Chair, sets the record with four of them, Mola Guthrum. And then Puddle Glum. See, Puddle Glum is a super important character. We've got to talk about him next week. But not only does he have this humble U sound, Puddle Glum, but he's modeled after someone that Lewis loved, which was his gardener and his handyman at the kilns, named Fred Paxford, who is famously a little bit dour, a little bit seeing the bad side of things. Like when Lewis was going to take his first airplane trip, he was like in his 50s, he was going to fly to Greece. He's like, oh, did you hear about the plane crash last week? You know? So that's exactly what Puddle Glum is in the story. He's a mournful kind of pragmatist, but he also ends up being, of course, the one who sees through the enchantments. So even though he's kind of he's a morose marshwiggle, but he ends up being the one who really has the sagacity to get them through on their quest.
He kind of expects trouble.
He does. He expects the worst.
Bad philosophy.
Yeah, he's not about ready to get bamboozled by a spell that's going to make it.
Reminds me of Eeyore.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, the other marshmallows think he's too lighthearted.
Yes. Yeah, when he meets the underland creature, he's like, this is just what I needed. This will sober me up. These guys haven't smiled in 400 years. But, so, you know, actually, so Lewis wrote a scholarly book called English Literature in the 16th Century, Excluding Drama. So this is a huge scholarly, like, encyclopedia reference that he wrote. And a lot of his, you could apparently trace a lot of his character names from things he learned when he was researching this. For one thing, there was a sort of a minor poet named John Studley in the 1500s in England who described the mythical river Styx from Hades or Hell as a puddle glum. And that's where he picked that up, probably. Puddle glum. So he picked up the name from a poet, and he picked up that U sound that he loved so much from his just love of vowels, you know, and the meaning of different sounds, and then he modeled it after his character, Paxford. So maybe that's where we should stop. So next week we'll talk about the Enchantress, you know, and some of the ways that Lewis is actually arguing with Sigmund Freud in some really amazing encounter there. He's taking on the atheist assumptions of the 20th century that Freud really popularized, which is really a terrible thing.
In the Silver Chair?
In the Silver Chair.
Can you say this is something that was that you're referring to?
The assumption, that there is no God, that the idea of God is an infantile projection by people who can't face reality, things like that. Sounds a little bit like a character in this whole shit. So we'll talk about her next time. All right, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I got a hand up.
Language, you ordered that, or did you?